one or two people asked me questions about that theorem yesterday. That's a big theorem. I hope it's kind of, you just sort of think about it. I mean, if you're not used to these things, if you just look at it and think about it, that it will make sense. It's a very abstract sort of a theorem. And it really is meant to be simply the natural generalization to G mod gamma of what Fourier transforms would be. And maybe if you have a little, if it seems a little still unclear to you, a good idea would be just to simply try to translate what it would say in the case of Fourier transforms. But maybe there's one point I could just emphasize, and that is that the thing that I wrote down right at the very beginning of yesterday, namely that in the domain of convergence, one shows really just formally that, well, even before talking about convergence, one shows formally that the Eisenstein series satisfy the intertwining property that E of x IP lambda y of phi is equal to E of x y phi lambda. And so so I didn't state this explicitly in the theorem. The theorem, I simply described an isomorphism, a unitary isomorphism from one Hilbert space, a rather elaborate Hilbert space, but one nonetheless which is meant to mimic basically what happens for Fourier transforms when you take the square integrable functions in the variable lambda that parameterizes the irreducible representations, as opposed to the original Hilbert space of square integrable functions in x. And Fourier transforms don't explicitly mention group representations either, so the Fourier transform, when one has Fourier transform defined, there's no mention really of group representations. But of course, the reason that Fourier transforms have to do with group representations is that R of y, this would be right translation now on a function, this would be phi, a function in L2 of R. And so the reason that Fourier transforms have to do with group representations is that R of y on phi, acting its Fourier transform at any point lambda, that's the same thing as the Fourier transform of phi at lambda times e to the lambda y. So right translation, so translation in the original space, the regular representation, after Fourier transform becomes pointwise multiplication by this one-dimensional character of the group. And so what you can think of this, the Hilbert space over here, as a continuous, as the space built out of a continuous direct integral of these representations, these one-dimensional representations parameterized by lambda. So there's a natural representation of R on L2 of the variable lambda, namely by pointwise multiplication, and there's a natural representation of R on L2 of R originally by simply right translation. And Fourier transform is the intertwining operator, the explicitly given intertwining operator that goes from the one representation, or the space of the one representation, to the space of the second representation. And so perhaps the reason why Fourier transforms, there's a couple of things that come together with Fourier transforms. This function really has two roles. It it represents a one-dimensional one-dimensional representation as a function of lambda of the additive group, but it also plays the role of the kernel, e to the lambda y, of the isomorphism from the one Hilbert space to the other. And it's that second role where it is parallel to the theory of Eisenstein series, e of x, e of, let's say, y C lambda. Now, what one follows from the theorem that I wrote down, what follows really formally, the fact that Fourier, the fact that this map, the one now in automorphic forms, is a unitary isomorphism between Hilbert spaces given by a kernel, an integral kernel, this thing, the fact that it's unitary means that its inverse, so we defined it as a map from L2 of the dual space, and it's not what we called L2 p hat, back to subspace L2 p of the original space. So we defined the map by you integrate a smooth function of lambda against this kernel, a smooth compactly supported function of lambda against this kernel, and then the resulting thing is a square integrable function of y. But in any case, the fact, the theorem asserts that that is a unitary map. And so if you have a unitary isomorphism from one Hilbert space of functions to another Hilbert space of functions that's given by a kernel, an integral kernel in two variables, then the inverse is given, if it's unitary, the inverse is given basically by the complex conjugate of that kernel. And so you can also write down just calculating the inner product of an arbitrary function in this space with the image under this map of a function in this space, and compare that to the inner product of the function you start with here with the pre-image of this, whatever it is, you get a formula for the map from here to here, the inverse of this map. And it's basically given by the complex conjugate of that kernel, exactly the way Fourier transforms work. You know that Fourier transforms preserve the L2 norm. That is equivalent to saying that if you know the inverse Fourier transform, which is what was our starting point here, we've set it up so it would have kernel e to the lambda y, then the Fourier transform would have a kernel, the complex conjugate of that, namely this. So just that theorem, which hides a lot of very difficult, intricate, and quite remarkable mathematics, much more very concrete mathematics, are hidden, are built into the proof of that theorem. But what it does, what it gives you, is really just formally, it gives you a second formula for the kernel. So now I'm talking about another kernel. I'm talking about the original kernel k of x and y of the operator r of f on L2 of gq mod ga. Remember, that was what we wanted to do. We're looking for a trace formula, and we're going to have a geometric side, which we will get to pretty soon, for trying to integrate the value of this kernel at x equals y, or rather the modified kernel that we got by adding some correction terms. That'll give us one part of it, but then we would want a kind of a parallel formula for this kernel that's given in terms of automorphic representations. And it comes just formally from that theorem. So what do we do? Let me write BP for a fixed orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space HP. And I can assume, I can take it from the dense subspace, HP0. consists of vectors in HP0. Okay, so the theorem that I just stated it implies that the kernel K of X and Y, which remember was given by really quite a simple and relatively explicit formula, that this has a second formula which may not look too promising. It might look rather abstract, but it formally can be written by just taking the isomorphism of, this is supposed to be an operator on L2 of G A mod G Q. Well, we've got an isomorphism from L2 of G A over G Q to this Hilbert space, or the direct sum of these Hilbert spaces, that's given also by a kernel, basically this function. And on these spaces, R of F is going to act by the induced representation IP lambda of F. And then we have an inverse map from here back to here that's basically given just by this kernel. So just the theorem amounts to saying that there's a second formula for the kernel gotten by taking the sum over all of these equivalence classes P, the sum over all P. It's more or less of the same general form that the isomorphism took, normalizing constants n of P to the minus 1, 1 over 2 pi I to the little p, integral over I A P star, and then just the sum over the elements phi in the basis BP of the two kernels, the kernel that gets you from here over to here, and then the conjugate of that kernel that gets you from here back to here. And in the middle, when you're over here, you let F act by the operator IP lambda of F. So in other words, this is E of X, IP lambda of F, acting on the orthonormal basis vector phi and lambda, and then the kernel E of Y phi lambda bar d lambda. Okay, so that this is a formula, another formula for K of X and Y. Now, I don't. That may not look too promising. It looks much more complicated. These Eisenstein series are quite elaborate functions. They're not even given by any concrete formula. They're given by an analytic continuation of a concrete formula. But sorry, this is the sum over P in script P. These were these equivalence classes of parabolic subgroups, and then it's just the same formula that the map in the theorem was defined. Yes. I'm sorry. No, of F actually. So here, I P lambda of F is the integral over G A of F of say U. I P lambda of U du. In other words, this is the operator obtained by integrating the given representation, this time the representation on this space, but integrating that representation against the function F. This is, after all, meant to be a kernel of the R of F. No, I'll just take a basis for every one of them, and it doesn't depend. You check that it doesn't depend on the choice of the orthonormal basis. Now, actually, there's one minor technical point on this, which I'm just going to sketch. There's really no reason, unfortunately, to say just off the top that this converges. This is actually an integral over an infinite space of infinite measure, and this is certainly a smooth function of lambda, as are these. But f itself is compactly supported, but its transform ip lambda of f won't be compactly supported. So you're really talking about an integral over a space of infinite volume here. And why does this sum? It's really a twofold. It's a sum and an integral converge. And I'm just going to sketch the argument. It's an abstract argument. It's a very simple idea that's due to Selberg. The problem being that that it's hard to estimate the growth of these functions e of x c lambda in lambda, because they are not very concretely given functions. You could estimate them pretty easily in the domain of convergence, because you have an absolute convergence integral. But where lambda is purely imaginary, that's gotten only by analytic continuation. So that might be, it's pretty hard to estimate that function. So the idea is the following. So just as a sketch, one can show that f can be written I'm not sure what the state of the art is now, but one can show that you can write f as a finite sum of convolutions of two functions. So you have a function on a group, and you can show basically by a little argument involving fundamental solutions of natural differential equations that occur at the real place of this group, that you can write f as a finite sum of convolutions of two functions, h1, h2, where h1 and h2, so what the original proof was that, in fact, you could do it for highly differentiable functions, h1 and h2. So m as large as you want. So I'm not sure. I think maybe, I don't know if anybody knows, but I think maybe it's known. Perhaps you could do it for infinitely differentiable functions. You could write f as a finite sum of convolutions. But in any case, it doesn't matter as long as m is sufficiently large. It would be and compactly supported. You could still form this thing, and it's still going to be well behaved. This thing is going to be well behaved as a function of lambda. But then what one does is one applies the Holder inequality to this double sum and integral. That basically says an L1 integral of a product of two things is bounded. I'm sketching this, but an L1 integral is bounded by the product of the two L2 integrals. So an application of Holder's inequality to the integral sum shows it is enough. So it bounds these two things in terms of L2 norms, and that it's enough to prove convergence for F equal to HI convolution. So this is convolution. These are convolutions of functions on the group. So for convolutions HI with HI star, where I is 1 into 2, and HI star of X is HI of X to the minus 1 bar. And with X equals Y. And then, this would take a page or two to actually do this precisely, but then one can show integrand under these special cases that you have a convolution of one function and its star function. This is called a positive definite function. And then when you set X equal to Y, you're talking about the kernel of a positive definite operator on the diagonal. And so the integrand is not hard to show, it's easily seen to be. So I'm talking about this integrand here, easily seen to be non-negative. And moreover, you're talking about if you take a compact subset of this and a suitable finite subset of this, then you're talking about the restriction of a positive definite operator, namely R of this F, to an invariant, a subspace. And the kernel of a positive definite operator that has a kernel, and you look at the kernel on the diagonal, but then you restrict that operator to an invariant subspace, its kernel on the diagonal will also be non-negative, and it'll be bounded by the kernel value on the diagonal of the kernel of the whole operator. So the integral over any compact subset of the domain gives the kernel of the restriction of a positive definite operator to an invariant subspace. And so this is going to be bounded by the kernel on the diagonal of the whole operator, let's ki of x and x, the sum over gamma in GQ of hi, convolution with hi star of x to the minus 1 gamma x, a finite sum. This is bounded. This is finite. This is less than infinity. And so it's just a sketch, but if you take any compact subset of this here, then the value on the diagonal of this the positive definite operator attached to this thing is going to be bounded by this thing. And so as you take an increasing sequence of compact sets in here, you've got positive integrands, and it's in fact bounded by this thing, and so therefore it converges. So this idea is due to Selberg. He had to use that even for SL2 because he was looking at discrete groups with non-compact quotient, which were more general than arithmetic groups, where in fact you can estimate for SL2 Eisenstein series. But he was looking at more general ones where there's no way to estimate Eisenstein series, and he just used this little trick involving functional analysis. So for the general argument, it's in this Duke Journal paper, 45, 1978, page 928 to 934. Oh, I'm sorry, I wasn't supposed to write here. Let me raise it. I forgot here to raise that for what it's worth. All right, so what this gives you is a pretty complicated, but nevertheless a completely different formula for the kernel. And you remember that we had the modified kernel, KT of X, is obtained from K of X and X, and the kernels of the induced representations KP of X and X for P not equal to G. And a similar formula for these things can be gotten from Eisenstein series. So there's a similar formula for the kernel. Maybe I'll have a Q here since I'm using Eisenstein series. I'm using P to index my Eisenstein series. So let's just, for this assertion, we'll talk about the kernels attached to parabolic subgroups Q not equal to G. And so then there's a similar formula for the kernel KQ of X and Y. Except all you have to do is you have to replace Eisenstein series E of X phi lambda by what you could call a partial Eisenstein series. Defined. So if you have a given Q, what would be relevant would only be parabolic subgroups P contained in Q, and the partial Eisenstein series, let's call it E upper Q, of X C lambda, is then the sum, by definition, the sum over delta, not in GQ mod PQ, but rather Q mod PQ phi of delta X e to the lambda plus rho P HP of delta X. And the theorem about Eisenstein series applies to these ones as well, because this PQ QQ mod PQ, this is the same thing. This is the same thing as MQ Q mod MQ Q intersection PQ. This is a parabolic subgroup in here, and this quotient is bijective with this. And so really, this partial Eisenstein series, when you take delta from here, it's really only happening in the M component of the variable X. So if you write X as N, M, K, it's really only the M component that this effects when you take these sums, the sum over this, and then the theorem applies as stated, except taking MQ, the reductive group MQ, instead of the group G. And so you get a formula for the kernel of this EKQ, and you'd have to sum. You would sum, not over all P, but over those P contained in Q. So we get, if you just remember what the modified kernel looked like, we get a pretty, what looks like a pretty abstract and maybe not so promising, but nevertheless a distinct formula, just not only for not only for K of X and X, but a second formula. So this gives a second formula, a spectral formula for KT of X in terms of Eisenstein series. Well, I hope to come back to this. I've got 6 days left, but I hope to come back to this and try to describe how you would deal with this formula to try to get explicit things out of it. But I'm going to go back now to the more concrete thing and try to outline a proof. This is really quite central to the whole geometric side, this thing I think I called Theorem 1. So I'm going to give an outline of how to prove Theorem 1. It's a pretty long proof, but on the other hand, it seems to suggest, it almost sort of starts to prove itself after a while. I mean, somehow the things suggest each other, and that if you just set up sort of the combinatorial things right, it really starts to prove itself. So KT of X, this is a function for X in GQ mod GA, or GA1 really. We're going to try to integrate it over GA1 mod GQ. Yes?
Is exactly Theorem 1?
Did I call it Theorem 1? It was. So this is the integral over GA. This was the theorem that we stated before starting to talk about Eisenstein series, that this is integrable. That's what we want to try to prove. So it's a question we're going to have to look at different points in GA mod GQ and try to show everywhere in GA mod GQ that you've got something that decreases fast enough that it can be integrated. So actually the first step of the proof is essentially the Borel-Serre compactification of GA mod GQ, or I guess I should say really an analytic restatement of the properties, the geometric properties that allow you to do the Borel-Serre compactification. But in order to set that up, I first have to state or recall, I haven't stated it, but many of you will be familiar with it, the theorem of Borel and Harish-Chandra on the approximate fundamental domain for GA over GQ. And so what is that fundamental domain, or approximation of the fundamental domain? It depends. What we'll do is we'll fix a point T0 in A0. So remember, A0 is the real vector space attached to the minimal parabolic subgroup, and it's the coordinates in this vector space that completely govern the non-compactness of the quotient, as we'll see in just a moment. So we'll fix a point in here, and we'll also fix a compact subset, omega, of NP0, so that's a unipotent group, and not all of MP0, but rather MP0 of A. So that's the complement of in MP0A of the space, A, the real vector space, or the coordinates given by the real vector space A0. And so for given just a pair of these things, one defines what I guess Borel and Harish-Chandra called a Siegel set, because Siegel, Carl Ludwig Siegel, had in fact proved theorems like this for special groups, particularly symplectic groups. And Borel and Harish-Chandra's contribution is done, as I think I mentioned, independently by Mostow and Tamagawa. Their contribution was to do what Siegel did for a general reductive group. And so one defines a Siegel set that depends on T0. Of course, it depends on G. And it also depends, actually, on this compact set, omega. And one defines it as the set of elements X in GA, such that when you write that they are products of three elements, where P is an element in this compact subset, omega, of NP0A times MP01. A is then in the complementary part, A0R0, and K is in K. Okay, so you can get any vector in GA can be, any point in GA can be written as a product of three such things. For anything in here, but you ask that P lie in this compact subset of this thing. And then you ask that the critical part is that you ask that A, that basically its logarithm, in other words, beta of HP0 of A minus T0, that this be positive for every beta in delta 0. So in turn, we were calling tau P0 the characteristic function in A0 of this set. So in other words, tau P0 of H P0 of X minus T0 is 1. And this is called a Siegel set. So maybe I'll draw later sort of pictures for it for SL2, in the slightly more interesting case of SL3, it's like the truncation parameter, it's similar to the truncation parameter. Remember SL3, we're looking then at A0 being the plane with three lines through it, and we're sort of conventionally taking this to be the place where all the positive roots are positive. And if you remember, we took a truncation parameter way out here, very regular there. Well, the T0, I want it to be the opposite. I want to be very generous with my T0, so I want the chamber, the translate of the positive chamber by T0 to be as large as necessary. So I take T0 to be maybe somewhere down in the negative chamber so that I get a large set where that is equal to 1. And then the theorem of Borel and Harish-Chandra, I'm going to state it as a lemma because it's our starting point, is So this is the theorem in the Annals of Math that I mentioned before, Borel, Harish Chandra, that you can choose T0 and omega such that the corresponding Siegel set represents every point in G mod gamma. So we can choose omega and T0 such that any point in GA can be written as a product of something in GQ and something in the corresponding Siegel set. Now, what this does not say, and in fact, what is not true, is it's not a set of representatives. There might be several for a point in here. There might be several different ways to write it as a product of something in these two sets. So it's not a fundamental domain. It's an approximate fundamental domain, in that it does represent every point in here, but not uniquely. So what we want to do is to describe, set this up more precisely, so we get something that it approaches. We're never going to get for general groups what we have for the modular group, where we really do have a very concrete fundamental domain for the action of SL2Z on the upper half plane. That's this thing. What the Siegel set is, what the domain from a Siegel set is, you take a point. So remember, for SL2, it's this positive axis that's the space A0, or really the exponential of the space A0. And so T0 is some point that's maybe, if necessary, highly negative. So it's exponential. That would be e to the t0 there. Its exponential might be quite close to 0. And then the set omega, well, remember, omega, in the case of SL2R, mp0a1 is essentially, certainly in SL2R, mpa01 isn't really anything. It's np0a that is the what is left for SL2R. And remember, NP acts on the upper half plane by horizontal translation. So what you do is you take omega to be sufficiently large, compact subset. So there's ET0, and there's omega. And so you're talking about points then, you're talking about points P, A, K. So you're allowing any k in the compact group, but when you're thinking about the upper half plane, you're taking k out. You're letting so it's really you divide out on the right by k. So we're looking at points in the upper half plane whose a component is bigger than e to the t. So we're looking at this. So this is the Siegel set for the upper half plane. And it certainly covers certainly arranged to have it cover the traditional fundamental domain. But what it doesn't do is give a precise fundamental domain. So this kind of stuff here that's happening down closer to the x-axis, it's easy enough to analyze in the case of SL2, but it's this kind of stuff that gets very, you just can't write it down in general. It's just too complicated. So it's this business that's happening away from infinity that would be too complicated to write down explicitly in general. But nevertheless, you write, so you forget about it. You just do this, and you get an approximation of the fundamental domain. I didn't add that in, but because I'm going to state something stronger in a minute. But part of what they also proved was that any element here has only finitely many different representatives in here. That's good. You just got that from the diagram. Yes. So let me state something that's more precise than that. Somehow what's happening down here is what complicates matters. So why don't we break this Siegel set up into two sets? Let's now take a point T, which is kind of like our truncation parameter, and we'll take it quite high up, and then we'll say, all right, the Siegel set is a union of the lower part. That's where the nasty complicated stuff is happening, but nevertheless a compact set. With the upper part, which topologically is much simpler. So by taking another point T, we're going to break up the Siegel set into a complicated compact set and a non-compact set. That's bad, of course, but whose topology is simpler. So we want to do that in general. So what we'll do is let's take a truncation parameter. So this is now a second point T in A0. So with the condition now that beta of T is very large. So by the way, before I even do this, let's fix omega and T0 for once and for all as in the lemma, as in lemma 1. And then having fixed them, let's now take a truncation parameter T, which is very regular, for every beta in delta 0. And then let me define a subset of the Siegel set, S upper G T0 T, S upper G omega T0 T, to be the set of X in the Siegel set, such that, so we've already then got this condition here, but now let's get an opposite condition involving the point T. Let's ask that the simple weights pi, this is this other basis of delta zero, at HP zero minus T, let's ask that be less than or equal to zero for every pi in this other basis, the second basis. All right, so what does that look like for SL3? So here we've got T0, and we're looking at points whose A0 coordinate lies in this chamber. Then we've got T up here, and we're then cutting it off. We're cutting this non-compact chamber off at T, so the simple weights are a dual basis to the simple roots. There's the simple roots, and the simple weights go along here. They go parallel to the walls of this chamber. And so if they're asked to be negative, you're taking perpendiculars to the walls of the chamber, and so you're asking that the A component lie in that compact set. So this would be HP0 naught of X. We're asking that it lie in this region. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. So what we want to do is we want something that generalizes to arbitrary groups, our intuition that we have for the upper half plane, whereby we write G A mod G Q as a disjoint union of a complicated compact set, complicated topologically, but that's okay. I mean, we like compact sets. They don't cause problems for integration. And a non-compact set, that's bad for integration, but whose topology is much simpler. We want to try to generalize that intuition or idea to a general group. So this is what we'll set up. We'll take our truncation parameter T, and then let me write F, capital F, upper G of T to be, well, why don't I just, what I'll do is I'll just take this truncated Siegel set, and I'm just going to project it onto GA mod GQ. I'll just project it onto GA mod GQ. So it's the projection, it's apart from the center of GA, it's then going to be a compact set. And I'm going to write this as the characteristic function of that compact set. So let this be the characteristic function in GA, in fact GA mod GQ, that is supported. So the characteristic function of the set obtained by projecting this Siegel set onto GA, my GQ. So supported on the projection of this truncated Siegel set S, G, T0, T on GA mod GQ. All right, so it's so since this truncated Siegel set is really a subset of GA, and remember we've always got the center of GA, which would be non-compact in general, but the intersection of GA1 with this truncated Siegel set is compact. This function f upper g is then compactly supported on g a 1 mod g q. Has compact support on GA1 mod GQ, but then the remaining complementary part, AGR0, it's going to be invariant because the fundamental weights are insensitive to translation by the split component of the center, and so it is invariant. Under translation. 0. Okay, now what I actually want to do is I want to get analogs of these things. So I'm basically writing, because we're talking about integrals, it's probably a little easier than, I mean, maybe some of you might disagree, but for me, if you're talking about integrals, I'd rather write geometric facts in terms of characteristic functions rather than So we're going to be translating geometric facts into functions that will set up our integration. And what we need is we would like an analog of this for every parabolic subgroup. So more generally, if you have a parabolic subgroup P, standard parabolic subgroup P, you can define a Siegel set of P, T0. You can define a truncated Siegel set, S, P, T0, and T. And you can define this corresponding characteristic function, f upper p of x and t, simply exactly as above, but with delta p0, those are the things that defined the positive chamber emanating from p0, delta p 0 hat, those are the things that define the negative chamber centered at T, and GQ mod GA, that was the set on which you made the projection and on which this was a characteristic function. Just replace these things by delta P0P, delta P0 P hat, and PQ mod GA. All right, so if you do that, then F upper P of X and T is the characteristic function of a subset of GA mod GQ. Namely, if X is equal to N M A K, N in N P A, M in M P A 1, A in AP R 0 and K in K, then F upper P of X and T is, if you make this construction, you're going to get a function that's the analog of F upper G for the reductive group M. So it's F upper P M of T. And it's in fact equal to the function F with G replaced by MP and evaluated at M instead of T. So it's going to be right invariant by the split component of M. And as a function in the MPA1, it's compactly supported modulo MPQ. All right, so now we've set up everything. We'll, right at the beginning now, I will state, next time we'll state, right at the beginning, the analytic version, really, of, I guess, what amounts to the Borel-Serre compactification. And we'll use that to start examining the kernel that we're trying to integrate, show is integrable.